Welcome, everybody, to the Reflex Blue Show. I am your host, Donovan Beery, and I have with me, correct me if I'm wrong here, the guy that drew the first Happy Meal box and the guy that's written every book that you can find on design.
I haven't written the Bible.
I guess technically that's a book on design, right?
It is. It's the book on design.
All right. Well, with that, welcome to the show, Stephen Heller and Seymour. Is it Quast?
Quast.
All right. I got that as close as I'm going to get it. I appreciate that. So, how are you guys doing over there today in New York?
Well, New York is a lovely place. It's a city off the coast of America, but it is the home of Donald Trump.
Oh, well, we're here in Omaha, which is on the coast of the Missouri River and home of Warren Buffett. So that's what we got.
Well, I think you trump us.
All right. Yeah. What's the city think about their native son there winning the Republican nomination, as it would be?
Well, our part of the city, because we don't talk to the other part of the city, is not very happy. But the other part of the city, I'm sure, is overjoyed.
Now, how many parts of this? I've only been in New York once, but there's a lot of parts of that city, right? Am I correct in saying that?
Well, there's Seymour's neighborhood.
All right, the Bronx and Brooklyn.
Okay.
Staten Island, Queens.
Okay.
And then within those places, there are lots of areas that are called neighborhoods.
Oh, fantastic. Just a quaint little town that you guys are in.
A quaint little province.
Yeah, that's wonderful. All right. Well, what are you guys working on like right now? I'll ask you first, Stephen. Every time I talk to you, you have like five books you're writing at one time, and I hear you're over 170 now. What are the current titles you're working on?
Well, the current titles are the graphic design idea book, the typography idea book, Slab Serif typography, the moderns. There are a whole bunch of books that I'm working on, but the one that's the most important at the moment is Seymour's book, Seymour Quast. At War with War.
And I guess that we'll just kick off and start with that. Seymour, you've got a book calling At War with War that's coming out.
Yeah.
And if you guys are, there'll be a link on the post at 36point.com for those who want to like link to what we're talking about. Or if you are listening by chance on iTunes, we have the link embedded. So click on the little graphic there.
And right now it's in the Kickstarter campaign stage.
Yeah. And that's what we're linking to is the little Kickstarter page. And I think you've got about 3 weeks left. So what made you think that, hey, I want to write a book about being at war with war? And what made you think that, hey, let's put this on Kickstarter?
Well, the book is, the text is a timeline from 3300 BC to the present here, pointing out that the wars have been going on all this time and they really haven't changed. They've just gotten... getting better at killing people. So I wanted to make some sort of statement about it, and I've illustrated 35 of those wars, and hopefully other people would be interested in at least being aware that there have been too many wars going on, and time to do something about it.
There's 5,000 wars that are listed in this timeline, which is quite a impressive number. And Seymour's been doing anti-war imagery for 60 or more years. So this is kind of, sadly, it just picks up from where his other work left off.
Now, how many of these wars have been, Seymour, have you actually covered, like, while they were happening? Like, because obviously not all 5,000, you weren't doing this in 3300 BC or anything.
The first war I remember is the Spanish Civil War, when I was about 5 years old. And, of course, there's World War II, unfortunately, which didn't have to happen, but because of World War I. Then there's Vietnam, and there's the Iraq War, Grenada, and a few others in between. And now the book sort of ends with ISIS, not knowing where it's going.
Sure, because part of the thing with the war machine isn't necessarily the current war, but it's about setting up the next one, I assume.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Every war leads to another.
Right.
And as long as you have a victor and a loser, the loser is always going to want to become a victor. And that was certainly the case with World War I leading into World War II, and then all the little skirmishes that happened after that.
So what aspect do you think that design plays in war? Like as a designer that's sitting here, you know, behind a computer, what aspect do we have that, because, you know, I'm not enlisted or anything. Like, what is my role in this?
It depends on where you're sitting. You know, there were lots of great designers who worked for the Office of War Information during World War II, and that was a very positive propagandistic office. It was a patriotic office that put a lot of posters and a lot of visual information into the world that was hooray for our side. On the other side, there were propagandists. On our side, it was patriotism, and on the other side, it was propaganda.
And I assume the other side sees it the other way.
Of course.
Yeah, depending on where you're sitting.
And what role do designers have in like what you're saying with the anti-war effort? And what can designers do on that aspect of it?
Well, the anti-war effort has always been, since the 20th century started warfare, there have been anti-war protests, and they kind of bring this often romanticized view of conflict into a proper perspective by showing the carnage that ordinarily wouldn't be covered by the press. And of course, designers gave us symbols that represent anti-war or peace, and Seymour gave us posters that have done that job as well.
And where do you recommend people go to see these posters if they're just viewing, if they're just listening to us now?
I have an archive online with my posters.
And what's your website address for those listening?
SeymourQuestArchive.com.
Fantastic. Do you see the war effort? Do you see any like positive outcomes that have come? Like, are there like I know there's a lot of like statistics that say that there's fewer wars than there ever have been, or that the world's safer than there has been. Do you see that, or do you only see that there's more wars coming up?
All you need is one war, and people are going to be killed. And if you look at the third world, you see a lot of wars. So there may not be world wars where many people from many nations are being blown up all at once. The UN has helped stave off some of that, but there's still an awful lot of armed conflict. I mean, when diplomacy fails, or when egos get the better of politicians, there's warfare. It's a tool of politics which runs rampant and runs wild. So I think the only good thing to come out of war are t-shirts and spam.
Penicillin.
I love it.
Well, penicillin, yeah, that was the Spanish Civil War.
And, of course, the ultimate war is the hydrogen nuclear war. That'll end all wars. I mean, that's one way to kill the wars, by having that one. But that is the scariest one of all.
No, that does not sound like the war that I want to have to do propaganda for on either side.
No,
you don't. But you know, there was a time when you ask how designers take part in this, both on one side or the other. During the 50s and 60s and even 70s, designers created imagery that kind of predicted or foretold of these horrible annihilations. And they ran in newspapers and magazines as kind of fiction. Some of it was meant to caution, and others were meant to excite. And now today we have all this warfare on video games and in films and in CGI. And people have lost touch with the reality of warfare because it's so mechanistic and it's so made into a cartoon.
Is that part of the reason, Seymour, is that part of the reason for your illustrating these wars, is to try to bring it back to reality and to show people that this isn't a cartoon, this is life and death?
Yeah, right, because war is not a game here. We have to show how serious it is. A lot is done with photography. We've all seen atrocities, of war doesn't seem to do enough in order to stop the next war, and I don't know how that will happen.
How would you like it to happen?
Well, it'd be nice if there was a terrific world government here that did not allow for the countries to go to war. You know, war it represents, you know, power. It's each side trying to gain power over the other side, and that's when the poor soldiers and the poor civilians are killed. They're the ones who suffer.
It's kind of like a cleaning of a forest. You know, every so often a forest has to burn down so that new growth can grow, and war has had that effect, which in a forest is positive, and in a world it's not very positive. And you know, this book that Seymour has done is kind of monumental in a way. It's not a huge book. It's not a biblical tome, but it's a book that kind of reminds us that we've been doing the same crap for so many years, and we just happen to be at a time now in the United States, for instance, where there's no draft, so my kids, your kids, are not going to be sent to war unless they join. But, you know, we grew up during the Vietnam War when there was a draft and people were going and just being used as cannon fodder, which is what war was all about, going back to the Egyptians.
No, I understand. Yeah, there is something where when it all of a sudden doesn't affect you personally, you just kind of forget it exists. And people don't realize, like, we're still, I think we've been at war now as a country for well over a decade.
It's well over a decade.
Like nonstop. There hasn't even been like a month off, like you know.
And there are people who are taking that responsibility, you know, who consider themselves patriots, and they are, who are going back for multiple tours of duty and to something that just is a total waste of humanity.
Now, when you started researching this book and deciding to do this, I realized you've been working with, you know, you've been talking about war with your career for years. But did it occur to you when you started that there's been 5,000 wars, or was it one where you thought, oh, you know, we'll just document wars and we'll probably come up to 1,000 or so, and then you're like, whoa?
Well, what I noticed going through the list of wars is that the countries go to war, they war with each other, then the cast of characters change, the countries change, and then they go back to war. The Ottoman Empire, though, they went into every war. So England and France were fighting each other. There's a 100 years war. It is amazing how it's like a wonderful activity for these countries. It glorifies them, glorifies who's the person in charge in these countries.
It used to be that, you know, it was the monarchs who were all related by blood somehow that went to war, and it was like it was a big game. They'd go on the battlefield and they'd have the young ones get shot. You know, it was all a matter of how many men would remain standing. And now that has been modernized so that it's a totally anonymous warfare where, you know, we're not fighting brother against brother. We're fighting people we don't understand, and they, in the process, they're being demonized. So war is not only unhealthy for children and other living things, it's unhealthy for our relationship to humanity, because somebody has to be the demon in all of this.
I assume there's a very few small percentage of these wars where they just end and everyone's like, oh, nope, we both won, and just walked away.
Well, that was what World War I was supposed to be. It was a standstill, and then...
And then it led to World War II.
Right.
Yeah, because the Germans were pissed at the treatment that they got.
Wow, yeah, I think I remember reading about that many times that... So the one war that ended, quote, well, ended up not ending well.
Well, it didn't end well because more people died on the battlefield than any other war prior to that. So it ended where there would have been some saving grace for everybody involved while they were picking up all the pieces. But then there were more pieces made.
All right. Well, We're going to be right back with Seymour and Stephen. All right, welcome back, everybody. I have with me Seymour Quast and Stephen Heller. So with war, we have your book, Seymour Quast, At War with War. What got you to decide to do a Kickstarter campaign for this book?
The subject matter, usually about, I try to get a publisher to do it the usual way, but it was not possible with the subject matter. And this seemed to be the only way to get the book out.
So this is a true passion project that you're self-publishing because you feel deeply about it. And it's starting to show.
Yeah, I had to do it. I mean, I do paintings with battles of, you know, airplanes shooting at each other. I'm completely obsessed by it. But doing this book is a terrific outlet for me, and I think it is important.
Okay, well, the design community appreciates it. And for those, once again, you can check on the link at 36point.com, or you can, if you're listening to this on iTunes, click on the graphic and go to the Kickstarter campaign, which should be up through June 9th of 2016. So while we're also here, you guys have both been in the field for a while. What's the biggest change you've seen in the design career over since you guys have started?
Well, I'd just like to mention Seymour's much older than I am.
Thank you.
But we've both been in for a while, and he's been in for much longer and has seen more and been around the block more. But, you know, the obvious things are changing in terms of technology. But out of technology comes a new school that is very much different from what Seymour was doing when he started out with Milton Glaser and Pushpin, which was highly visual, mostly print and some animation. And now the field is just a multiplicity of media and platforms where things like strategy and user experience and IX and things like that, all these initials have popped into the field that didn't exist before, and we have to kind of reevaluate what we do, how we do it, and where we do it.
Yeah, designers now collaborate with architects and publishers, and designers have gotten into other aspects of things where they can contribute. They've become much more important. Designers and illustrators are no longer just vendors for other people. Now they are, I think there's some more respect than they used to have, but they're much more involved in every aspect of culture.
And they're also entrepreneurs, as you know, you are, Donovan, doing this podcast. You've ventured out into an area that you are the boss of. And so designers have always had that ability, but this is the era when they've taken charge of that and have become makers and founders and all the other buzzwords that have come out.
Was there a time in history where you like saw something, like maybe design was mentioned on the front page of the paper or something, where you realized that change was there, or do you think it's just happened slowly?
Well, there is a point at which designers were featured more in feature sections of newspapers. And I wrote a lot of obits for a lot of deceased designers at the New York Times. And that suggested that they were being given more respect as professionals and as contributors to the culture. But, you know, there have been design magazines and design books going back to the turn of the century. William Morris and the Roycrofters, even though they were kind of cultish design operations, they were entrepreneurial and they put things into the world that are now very popular on a mass scale.
I'm just picturing you writing an obit for a designer and saying like, wow, we've made it.
Well, the first obit I wrote was for Paul Rand, but Paul Rand was already highly respected as something more than just a service vendor.
Yeah,
the illustrators who worked for mass magazines like the Saturday Evening Post were respected. They became millionaires, There was a different time where people watched what they did in those magazines.
Yeah, they were like stars of their day. And Charles Dana Gibson, who created the Gibson Girl, he made a fortune on that property. And he also edited a magazine called Life, not the Life magazine that Henry Luce published, but the Humor magazine, which featured a lot of these great illustrators like Lion Decker and Coles Phillips and people like that, who were literally the stars of their age.
But now people seem to be very conscious of logos. You know, when Gap changed their style of their logo, yeah, there was an uprising. People were very upset about that.
Oh, we did an entire podcast on that logo change.
Right. Yeah, and ever since, every time a logo changes, I, for one, get 3 phone calls from different news organizations. And sometimes I don't even know that the logo had changed. But there has to be some commentary. And there always has to be, why does it suck? And then, why doesn't it suck? It comes down to that. And my response lately is, you know, people will get used to almost anything.
Right. Ford tried to change the style of their logo on their cars, and they found it just didn't work. So they went back to the old sort of Victorian style that they had, and it's still there.
And that leads to the other really big change in design, and that's branding. Or as Paula Scher says, blanding. You know, this whole idea that what used to be called corporate identity has blended with what used to be called narrative. And now there are these stories about products that are paid for in large sums of cash so that they can influence the marketplace. And so branding and brand strategy and all that grew up around it is a huge part of the design profession. And it's just bits and pieces of things that already existed brought together as a new genre.
No, now do you think people take a bigger effect and they take a bigger interest in like when logos change because they're more attached to brands and they think that it's part of who they are? Or do you think it's just because there's nothing else to write about?
Well, logos are sort of friendly. They can become they're comfortable with what they know, and then they see something different that it's upsetting.
Yeah, it's like if you left your house in the morning and outside there were roses and gardenias and it was painted white, and you came back and it was purple and orange and there was cactus, you would be upset. And while that may be a radical version, that's what happens when people do get attached to friendly logos. It used to be, in the turn of the century, they were called friendly trademarks. And different trademarks would be inviting for the consumer. And therefore, they were imbued with this great amount of value. And people feel that way now. You know, they also don't want to be misled. You know, sometimes a change in a logo means the product is going to change.
And what was there like a logo before Gap or something where you actually noticed like when actually people started calling you and getting things? Like, was there like a turning point on this, or is this something that's also, you think, happened gradually?
Well, Gap, the original logo was nothing very special, except that it had a certain character, and the revise of that took away whatever character there was. And that is a problem with a lot of corporate logos, is that they were mostly set in Helvetica and made very neutral and without character.
And the Gap was also called Fall Into the Gap before it was called the Gap. And that was the entire title of the store. It was a jeans store. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are always these histories, like the A&P became Food Emporium. Those are fascinating stories, because why brands change from one thing into another is part of the economy, it's part of the culture, it's part of the history and all. But I think that, you know, logos became popular at the turn of the century, and primarily in Germany. There were a number of great minimalist logo designers who showed that a corporation didn't need a funny character to represent its holdings. And these corporations started becoming global. And once you became global, you needed a mark that didn't say an awful lot, but it did remind whoever was looking at it that that was the company they were looking at.
So do you think the natural evolution of this is that once somebody becomes a global brand and creates a logo, they'll never be able to change it?
Changing a logo is difficult because it's already been established and people recognize it. Yeah, corporations don't change their logos easily.
Paul Rand says they refine the logos. You can refine something. And even the refinements now come under scrutiny. You know, a case in point was Verizon, which was, by all intents and purposes, that big check mark.
That was the most needed of a logo redesign of all time, I think.
It was needed, but, you know, people started arguing about the efficacy of the new logo. So, you know, you can't really win. Hillary Clinton's logo was raked over the coals, and over time it's proven to be a very durable and wonderful logo.
And that's a logo that really will only last a few years. It's meant for a short time as well.
Well, hopefully, and I'm being partisan here, it'll last for 8 years.
Well, I mean, even then, I think she'll probably, you know, you revise it on a re-election campaign, but it's not like a 20-year logo is all I'm thinking.
No, it's not, but it's, you know, it still has all the power, the charged qualities of any corporate logo. You know, the swastika, which I've written two books about, it was meant to be a 1,000-year Reich logo, even though it was a 10,000-year sign before it was a logo. So time is not the issue so much as what these logos stand for and mean.
Okay, that's very insightful.
I'm an insightful guy.
Well, we appreciate it. Stephen, Seymour, I really appreciate your time this morning. Check out Seymour's Kickstarter campaign. We'll look forward to the book coming out. And we'll be in touch.
Right. Thank you.
Hope so. Thanks, Donovan. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
The Reflex Blue Show with Donovan Beery is hosted at 36point.com. Music by Dustlab. Find out more at myspace.com/dustlab.